I never got any money from you.
UFO might just as well stand for Unprecedented Financial Opportunity.
Be normal.
And this is The Saucer Life, a podcast in which we examine concepts, events, or people orbiting the world of flying saucers. Few preconceptions, snark when justified, no belief, no debunking. Today, we're going to look at an often requested but somewhat daunting topic, Gulf Breeze, the sightings. And this will be followed next time by Gulf Breeze, aftermath and abductions. Why two parts? Because there's a lot, way more than I figured. And I didn't want to shortchange anything interesting. Now, making this a two-parter is a last-minute change to the structure of the episode, so we will see how it goes. This is either going to be a brilliant piece of decision-making, or it's going to be something where I end up with a 20-minute episode followed by a 90-minute episode, which would be a bit unbalanced. But you can look at your podcast app or web page, or wherever you're playing this, and know how long this episode is. As I sit here right now, recording this introduction, I have no idea how long this episode is going to be. So, let's get started. So just in case you didn't know, the Gulf Breeze sightings were a series of sightings and photographs of sightings in Gulf Breeze, Florida, which is in the panhandle not far from Pensacola, small little town. This happened in late 1987 into early 1988. And we're going to be looking at the Gulf Breeze sightings primarily through the words of Ed and Francis Walters. While we'll bring in other sightings and other sources and things like that where appropriate, it's very much the story of Ed and Francis Walters and their experiences. Now, in true Saucer Life fashion, I'm not going to be passing judgment on their sightings or on their photos. I'll be describing the sightings. I'll be quoting passages from their books. I may invoke fair use and share my two favorites of the pictures out on the social media, but I'm not here to declare whether this was a hoax or not. I'm going to tell you the story based on the sources from the time. Now, in many ways, and for better or for worse, for me, the most interesting aspect of the sightings is the story of the Walters encounters, how they reacted, and how the UFO community reacted to them and their story and the fallout from that. And that's why this is going to be a two-parter, because there's a lot of sort of UFO cultural stuff to get in here. So the Walters' first book, Ed and Francis Walters' first book, The Gulf Breeze Sightings, hit the shelves in 1990, so a couple years after the sightings were over. And following an introduction from abduction researcher Bud Hopkins, we jump right into Ed Walters' first sighting, which took place on November 11th, 1987. It was about 5 p.m. Ed Walters was in his home, and as he worked in his office, something caught his eye out the window. My eyes caught a slight movement of light between the pine's limbs. I sat up and leaned over my desk to get a better look. It was still behind the tree, but I could now see that the glow was unusual, quite different from any of the commonplace planes and helicopters that populate the sky with their comings and goings from the Naval Air Station right across the bay. I still couldn't see clearly enough through the pine boughs to satisfy my curiosity. I went to the front door and opened it. Whatever it was I had seen was still behind the tree, but I could tell now that this was glowing, bluish-gray craft was like none I had ever seen before. This was right out of a Spielberg movie that had somehow escaped from the film studio. It was impossible, but there it was, glowing and gliding along like a cloud. There was a quiet in the air. As I stared at the craft, the hairs on my arms bristled. This was no movie prop gone astray. My first thought was to call the police, but then I realized no one would believe me without proof. I rushed back into my office and grabbed the old Polaroid camera I used so frequently on my job sites. Quickly, I stepped back into the small porch area. I took my first picture as the craft came from behind the pine. The craft was still partially concealed by a branch. I moved the camera from my eye to get a better look. My mind told me there was some perfectly logical explanation for it all. My eyes told me something I absolutely didn't want to believe. This was a UFO. Something that just could not be. Looking at photo one, and we're not going to talk about every single photo in detail because describing photographs on an audio-only podcast is, boy, that's tedious even for this show. But it is a sort of round, very sort of structured looking craft with a light on top and a glowing section underneath. It is coming out from behind a tree. And the caption says that it's overlapped by the tree, which offers conclusive evidence for authentication. Everything has sort of a blue tinge, even the light blasted and enhanced version of the photo. Now, again, not to get into photographic details that can get a little tedious, these are Polaroids. Kids, ask your parents about Polaroids, but these are instant photos, and it was an old camera, and I believe, if I remember, one thing I read somewhere, and people will probably correct me if I'm wrong, that he might have been using expired film, which can affect the colors especially. To continue with Ed's narrative, he's freaked out, obviously, but he did have the wherewithal to notice some specific details about the craft. He said his attention was sort of drawn to and focused on the bright glow of the power source, or what he perceives to be a power source, radiating energy from the bottom of the craft. But it freaked him out, right? So why is it slowly descending over what he called a peaceful residential neighborhood? It made no sense. It was too low to the ground. Someone was sure to see it. Surely, if they were, or whoever was on it, was observing or photographing, he says, they could do that from a much higher altitude because it's a spaceship. Were they having engine trouble? Was it actually an American experimental military craft? Pensacola Naval Air Station is right there. So he's having these thoughts, he relates later, going through his head as he's studying this. But he does provide some pretty specific details about its appearance. What I was looking at is probably not what you would expect if you closed your eyes and imagined a UFO. It was unlike science fiction and Hollywood depictions of a flying saucer. The pictures I took are clear, but it's not like seeing it firsthand. In person, it was an awesome sight and an unforgettable experience. It seemed to be nearly as big as the houses below it, and three times as high. It glided along without a whisper of sound. There was no hum, no wind, not a single disturbance to the air, trees, or houses as it passed over them. While rocking back and forth, it did not seem to spin, so I never saw all sides, only what is in the photographs. I estimated it at 200 feet above the ground, 60 feet in diameter, and 35 feet from the top dome to the bottom of the power light. Later, it became very obvious that the UFO wasn't nearly this large, but having nothing to compare it with and not knowing just how far away it was made it impossible to be sure of the size. Being excited didn't help either. A lot of small details don't show up in the photos. Central between the large black squares that look like windows were small openings that I believe were portholes. Some of the portholes were lit, some were not. There were also some diamond shapes between some of the large black squares. And unseen in the photos, there were definitely horizontal lines going around the main body. But Ed continued to be transfixed by the bright light glowing and emanating from the underside of the UFO. Bang! Something hit me, all over my body. I tried to lift my arms to point the camera. I couldn't move them. They were blue. I was blue. Everything was blue. I was in a blue light beam. The blue beam had hit me like compression. It was pressing me firmly, just enough to stop me from moving. I screamed with my mouth frozen half open, but the sound was hollow, dead, like a vacuum. I couldn't even move my eyes or eyelids. I thought that I was dying. I was trying to breathe. There was air, but my chest wouldn't expand. I had to pant to get enough air, each breath shallow. This was it. I was dying. My brain was being squeezed and felt like it was going to crack open. The right side of my forehead felt like it had a knife piercing through to the back of my eye socket. No air. I needed air. Panicky, I tried to suck in air. The best I can tell, this all took less than 20 seconds. Then my feet lifted off the ground. I screamed. A voice groaned in my head. We will not harm you. I screamed again. The deep computer-like voice said, calm down. But it was in my head, not my ears. I screamed as well as I could. Put me down! A few seconds passed by as I slowly rose away from the pavement. A dream? Hell no, this was real. The feeling of helplessness was the worst. No control, just a piercing smell, a little scent of ammonia mixed with heavy cinnamon that scorched, then stuck to the back of my throat. My heart was pumping so hard I could feel its throb as it thumped against my unmoving chest. I could feel the thumping vibration pass down my legs. The voice groaned, "Stop it." I screamed, "Screw you!" All this happened fast. Now I was about 2 feet above the street. I panted for air, but the smell stung my lungs. My brain started to black out, so I screamed. After a little bit, The aliens, let's just call them that, the aliens let Ed go. He drops down a couple feet to the sidewalk. The craft goes away, but the ammonia cinnamon odor lingers, and it's still lingering when Ed's wife, Frances, comes back and he tells her what has been going on. She's concerned. He wants to share this with other people to find out if anybody else saw what he saw, experienced what he experienced, but he's concerned about whether or not he will be ridiculed. He's a figure in the community. It's Gulf Breeze is a small place, 5,000-6,000 people at the time, I believe. And he was a prominent home builder. You know, it's difficult to put yourself out there in this kind of situation. But in the end, Ed decides to send the photos to the press, writing out a letter signed Mr. X. Now, the plan is for Ed to take the photos to a guy named Dwayne Cook, editor of the local newspaper, the Gulf Breeze Sentinel, I think it was a weekly newspaper, and say that this mysterious Mr. X had asked Ed to submit the photos and the letter. And the plan was basically hoping that no one suspected that Ed was the person who had the UFO sighting, that Ed was in reality Mr. X. Now, the photos and letter were published in the November 19th, 1987 edition of the Gulf Breeze Sentinel. It read, in part, "To whom it may concern, on the night of November 11th, I took the pictures you now see before you. I was reluctant at first to show them to anyone but my family, but my wife convinced me to show them to Ed. Ed, in turn, said that the photos should be shown to the press. This is why he is presenting them to you. There was nothing colorful about it, no flashing lights, no beams coming from it, none of that Star Wars stuff. It was just a dull gray-blue thing. I don't think that it was military, but you may want to check. It was quite big, and I don't think I was alone in seeing it. I wish to remain anonymous, but if these photos and stories spark any interest from your readership, I may identify myself. I am a prominent citizen of the community and need anonymity at this time. I know what I saw and would feel much better if I knew I was not alone. Let me reassure you, this is not a hoax. I saw what I saw, took pictures of it, and have given these pictures to you. I wish I could come forward but cannot, for while I have nothing to gain, I have everything to lose. Thank you for your time and understanding." What I omitted from this letter was just the description of how the craft looked and moved, some of the details that I shared earlier from the excerpt from the book. I think it's interesting what Ed Walters did not discuss. He did not discuss the smell. He explicitly said there was no beam. There was no color, whereas it was bluish gray before, and there was a blue beam and a voice. He cuts that stuff out. He's trying to make it a bit more credible, trying to see perhaps what other people say before he says things that make him sound really kind of out there. Now, the Sentinel had an editorial comment following the letter from the mysterious Mr. X. "These Polaroid photos were taken from the front yard of a Gulf Breeze residence Wednesday evening, November 11th. If anyone saw it or knows any information regarding this, please contact the Sentinel." The day after the Mr. X letter appears in the Gulf Breeze Sentinel on November 19th, that was November 19th, so the next day, November 20th, Ed has his second sighting. This time, he has sort of a precursor event. He hears this hum inside his head, and sometimes it's soft, sometimes it's louder, sometimes it's overwhelming, and to the point where his family, his wife and his teenage kids are concerned about them. The hum would come, the hum would go. He goes out to the pool. He thinks it might be the pool pump. He doesn't know what it might be. Then later in the afternoon, about 5 o'clock again, so in November, even in Florida, getting a little darker, a little more towards twilight, he's hearing the hum. His breathing is heavy. He's sweating all over his body, and he shouts, "I hear you, you bastard. I know you're there." And this is something, we saw this with the "screw you" comment earlier during the first sighting. Ed kind of presents himself as kind of a tough guy in the face of whatever these things are. Then he hears a voice, which is saying words in a language that he thinks is an earth language, but he doesn't understand. He says it sounds kind of African. But then when he's outside and he's shouting at the aliens, they show up. "Be calm. Step forward," said the forceful voice. I raised the camera, following the downward path of the UFO. "Don't do that." Another voice, definitely a female voice that sounded distorted. "Please don't do that." another voice in Spanish, Las fotos son prohibido. The female voice, you can't expose them. They won't hurt you. Just a few tests. That's all. Right, if I want to be examined, I'll let you know. I shot picture number 6 as the UFO suddenly stopped its fall and hung there frozen, just beyond the power pole at the front of my yard. Somehow I could hear them talking to me, just as if we were all on the telephone. All the voices were deep, garbled, and somewhat computer-like. Whether they were actually hearing me or just reading my mind, I don't know. The UFO shot over to my right, almost like a hummingbird, and hovered there. It seemed to be spinning from left to right, but very slowly. Ever so slightly, it would tilt toward me and then away, which I noticed because the big power light at the bottom grew larger and smaller. The craft lit itself up and was bright. It was so bright. In fact, I still can't believe someone else didn't see it hovering there. The UFO voice said, "Step forward. We will bring you aboard." "No way. What gives you the right to suck people up into your ship against their will?" "We have the right." I remember thinking that the being was talking to me as if I were an animal. "Here, Rover. Sit, Rover. What a good Rover." Click. I took shot number 8. The female voice. "You must do what they say. They haven't hurt us, and we are going back home now." Now visions blasted into my brain of naked women. These were not drawings of naked women, but actual naked women. Flash after flash, each lasting about 5 seconds. Big women, little women, fat, black, white women from every race and every age. There were even pregnant women. If this was meant to encourage me to come aboard, it didn't work. I stayed right where I was. Ed acknowledges that this sighting was much more frightening than the first one, but he keeps taking pictures. He takes several pictures so that the threats from the aliens seem a little hollow. Eventually, again, they go away. The voices leave his head. The humming leaves his head. He tells his wife what happened, and he decides that he needs to take some precautions because they said they're going to come back for him. So he loads his .32 caliber pistol. He loads his .22 caliber rifle. He says, if I'd had a machine gun, I'd have loaded that too. So he's got a shotgun. He's got his pistol. He's got a rifle. He begins to carry the shotgun in his pickup truck behind the seat. He's ready for them if they come get him. And then, soon after this, in the next issue of the Gulf Breeze Sentinel, we start to see some indication that Ed Walters was not the only one seeing strange things in the sky. One of the witnesses who shared his experience was a man named Charles Summersby, who was a former editor of the Gulf Breeze Sentinel, so that carried quite a bit of weight. It was just a few minutes after sunset on Veterans Day, and wife Dari and I were just finishing up our evening walk along Hickory Shores Boulevard in the Midway area. We looked out over East Bay to admire the cloud formations when our attention was drawn to a round object moving in a southwest direction toward downtown Gulf Breeze. There were bright lights around the bottom, another at the top. None of the lights were colored or flashing. Our thought, it's not an airplane, not a helicopter, not a bird. What is it? Movement of the unidentified flying object was steady. No hesitation and no apparent change of course. Watched the local news on television that evening and looked through the morning paper to see if anyone had reported the apparition. When it appeared no one else had been looking up at the sky at that moment, we forgot about the incident until the pictures appeared in last week's Sentinel. Unfortunately, didn't have a loaded camera or binoculars with us at the time of the sighting. Summersby wasn't the only one who had seen things. An article by Joe Turner and Allison Brown in that issue of the Gulf Breeze Sentinel detailed other sightings that happened on the 11th when Ed Walters had his first one and when the Summersbys saw their craft. On November 11th, around 8 in the morning, Jeff Thompson of Gulf Breeze said he saw a flying object from Tiger Point Bay over Oriole Beach School. Thompson was taking his son to school at the time, saw the object shoot up from the right at an angle, suddenly stop, hold there for 30 to 45 seconds, and then sort of took off at a high rate of speed. Now, it had the same window-type formations as the photo, but it did not have the brightly lit bottom portion. So that is a big difference. Thompson also said that after the UFO sped away, two jets were chasing the object. Another witness, around the same time as Walters had his sighting, about 5:30 to 6:30 p.m., was Linda Lube of Gulf Breeze. She witnessed a type of light, she says, moving very slowly across the sky southeast toward Gulf Breeze. She watched it for about 15 minutes while outside cooking. She said, "I had a feeling it was from another place. I didn't have my glasses on, so I couldn't see the form, but I could tell I've never seen anything like it." She expressed her feelings as, quote, "almost a premonition." And then when she saw the Sentinel less than a week later, she said she felt that same unexplainable inner feeling. Now, the article also said that the Florida chapter of MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, would be sending investigators to talk to the witnesses and to gather information about the sightings. Now, on December 2nd, speaking of sightings, Ed Walters had his third encounter with whatever it was. And like previous encounters, there was a kind of precursor event. This time, it wasn't necessarily a hum. It was hearing voices talking in Spanish and hearing a baby crying and then hearing a conversation. Female voice. "She wants some milk." Male voice. "If they don't give us something other than bananas, I'll..." "Hush, they'll hear you." "But why do they just eat bananas?" "I know this sounds bizarre, and I was tempted not to tell it, but bananas are what they were talking about. I lived in Central America for about 5 years and speak Spanish to a modest degree, although I can understand it even better." Male voice. "Ije puta." "I'm not sure about the spelling, but it translates to a slang version of son of a bitch. I mention this because I remember hearing it in parts of Nicaragua and Costa Rica. Maybe the voice is home." "Son of a bitch, look at all those, maybe 20. What's happening?" "I saw them like that last night. The chief said they were taking on power fuel." The baby was still crying. By now, of course, I was wide awake. Sweat soaked my back and rolled down my underarms. I was afraid to move and afraid not to. I knew the UFO was there, but did they know I could hear them? If it seems a little confusing, that's because it is. It kind of jumps around a little bit. It's a very strange story. You get a sense in the way that he tells it. He's sort of conveying the sort of disorientation he's feeling in the face of some of this strange stuff. So he's trying to figure out what to do. Should he call the police? Should he look for wherever the voices are coming from? That's what he wants to do. He tries to grab the pistol in the nightstand. He's going to creep around looking for them. His wife says, no, she's not going to do that. She's going to help him. So there they are. They're crawling around. And then the hum begins. The voices stop. The hum begins. They go to the door. They look out the door towards the pool. They go outside. They start to panic because the UFO shows up. I still had the gun in my hand. I tried to be rational, to think. No shooting, not yet. Maybe we can talk, maybe not. They have a supercraft, they have telepathy and all that, but advanced culture? I doubted it. Advanced culture should be civilized. Maybe try some manners, perhaps. Please may I suck you up into our craft? No, you may not. Okay, thank you anyway. And they'd leave you alone. Not these guys. They didn't bother to ask, they just did what they pleased. I cracked the door again. The UFO stopped. The UFO voice ordered, "Step forward now." "Not in this life," I muttered as I took the Polaroid camera from the breakfast bar. Feeling a bit emboldened by his defiance, Ed goes outside even further, takes more photos, ducking behind trees, watching the craft move around, change colors from orange to white and so forth. And then they eventually leave. And he does something that he thinks will help with the situation. He says, "Earlier, I had mistaken the UFO hum for the pool pump. That wouldn't happen again. From room to room, I checked for anything that hummed. The refrigerator, unplugged it. The aquarium pump, turned it off. The central heater, off. By the time I was through, the house was quiet. Satisfied, I returned to my bedroom." He's trying to eliminate all the possible sounds of humming because the humming will alert him to the UFO and he doesn't want any false alarms. But this time, this sighting was a little different. Frances, his wife, had seen it. So she had believed him. She saw the photos. She trusted his judgment. But this was a little bit different. She said she was terrified. She was concerned about Ed's safety when he went out to take more photographs. So Also, Ed says, on December 2nd, they had a fourth sighting, but it was around 3:30 a.m., which technically is December 3rd. But this time, they see a creature. When we come back from the break, we're going to see a creature. Well, not see, you know what I mean. But we'll take a little break now, and we will return to Ed Walters, Francis Walters, and the UFOs over Gulf Breeze. Next time, we're staying on Gulf Breeze. I was envisioning two parts. It might be more. I don't know. It's fun. It's a wild story. Thanks for your feedback and your comments and your kind words about our fifth anniversary and our fifth anniversary episode last time. One bit of an update. One of you asked a question about the first alien hybrid, and I completely blanked on it. And as I knew would happen, one of our erudite listeners got in touch. Martin Kottmeyer sent me a whole list of early hybrids, sort of the pre-abduction era hybrids. And when I saw Cynthia Appleton's name as one of the earliest ones in the 1950s, that, of course, you know, triggered in me the memory of Elizabeth Clarer from South Africa, who had a child with Akon the spaceman. And I think we covered Elizabeth Clarer's story on our fourth episode. I think that was the first one the saucer wife appeared on. So go back into the archives and check out Elizabeth Clarer's story for the first alien human hybrid, or at least one of the earliest I have ever encountered. If you like the Saucer Life and want more, you can support us in exchange for bonus content from both this show and our other Chizo Media podcast, Great Lakes Lore. You can check it out at patreon.com/chizomedia or via the link in the show notes. You can check out past episodes at saucerlife.com, or you can find those on your favorite podcast app. As always, we're on Twitter and Instagram at saucerlife, and you can email us at thesaucerlife@gmail.com, or you can contact us by post at Chizo Media, P.O. Box 68, Grand Blanc, Michigan, 48480. All right. And you can reach out with questions and comments that we'll address during this midway segment on the subsequent episodes. So if you have any questions about what we're doing with Gulf Breeze so far, or where we might be going in the future, be sure to let us know those. For right now, though, let's go back to Florida. I mean, for those of you who aren't there already, I think we've got some listeners in Florida. But anyway, back down to Florida. So it's a few hours later. It's 3:30 a.m., and Ed and Francis are in bed. And then the dog barks. Ed wakes up. He goes to the window. He opens up the blinds. He looks out. There's a small creature just on the other side of the glass. They're inches away from each other. Ed screams. The creature just stood there, staring in at me. It was maybe 4 feet tall. A dark, grayish-black box-like thing hid most of its body. The helmet over its head had a clear insert that revealed its eyes, really big eyes that covered the top half of its head. It grasped the glowing silver rod in its right hand. By this time, Frances is awake and has seen the creature as well. She is actually closer to the creature. She's crawling across the bed towards Ed. He has the pistol in his hand. He points it at the creature. He says, "I'm not going to shoot it unless it tries to get in." Ed says the creature looked at him fearlessly, and then it just turned around and walked away. Anger swept through me. That little bastard had just scared me out of my mind, and now it was just going to walk away? The hell with that. I wanted him. I scrambled from the floor and got back to the door in a few steps. The deadbolt and passage lock were impossible to operate without putting the camera and gun on the floor first. I unlocked the door and, without picking up either of them, ran onto the porch. The creature was steadily moving across the deck and toward the stairs. I was about 20 feet behind, intent on capturing it. Moving as slowly as it was, I could catch it in no time. I'd throw a body block and drag the little critter back into the house. I pushed open the screen door and took 2 steps onto the wooden deck. Bang! The blue beam angled down from the sky. My right leg, from the knee down, was hit, frozen like it was nailed to the floor, being squeezed. I fell. My forward momentum made me pull and twist my knee as I fell. My right leg was stuck in place. Shit! I screamed. Frances ran onto the porch to help me, and I yelled at her to get back. The blue beam began to lift my leg and pull me out from under the roofed porch. I leaned back and grabbed the screen door jamb. As I leaned back, I was looking straight up into the bottom of the UFO. It was maybe 50 feet up, with the beam just clearing the eave. The sight was enough to make me shudder, and I almost lost my grip on the door jamb. No wonder the creature was in no hurry to get away. Its buddies were there. Maybe this was all a trick to get me outside. If it was, it worked. My left foot tipped into the blue beam as I tried to pull myself away. I felt the pressure on my toes, and it wrenched it away. I jerked wildly, but my right leg stayed fast in the beam. Frances held me from behind. I pulled harder. Slowly and steadily, my leg came out. I was free. The blue beam disappeared, and the craft hovered toward the field. The creature had gone across the back field. I heard it go through the chain-link gate in our fence. I scrambled to get my camera. By the time I got back with the Polaroid, the craft was near the trees. Suddenly, the blue beam shot down to the ground. No way to see the creature, but I figured they were picking up the back porch visitor. I shot photo 11. So there are a couple of things going on here. We've got a creature, and it's not a gray, except for the big black eyes. It's not really a gray. If it's a gray wearing this weird blocky suit of armor carrying a silver rod. And Ed says at another point in the book that he says it's a silver rod, not because that's the color of the rod, but because it, in his words, glowed silver. We also have the blue beam grabbing him and pulling him up into the ship, but he's able to resist it by hanging onto the door jamb and his wife Frances sort of holding on to him. And that, I mean, the beam must not be very strong if he can just hang on. Now, he talks about photo 11. If we look at photo 11, or if I look at photo 11, in both the regular one and the light blasted and enhanced for detail enlarged version, you see a craft that looks sort of flying saucery, and you do see a beam, much more faint in the unenhanced version. You do see a beam going down to the ground, and that beam is blue. And again, I'm not casting aspersions, I'm not making judgments, but it looks really fake to me. It just does. I'm not saying all the photos of the UFOs look fake. I just think the ones that show a large amount of detail look kind of fake. But what's interesting about it, and I'm not an optical physicist like the people like Bruce Maccabee who authenticated these photos, but my question is, in what way, how does light work? That's kind of my question. How does light work? How does the beam, this tractor beam, sort of engage in a visual spectrum to look blue to the human eye? How would that translate to a Polaroid lens and a film? What I'm saying is, why does there have to be a visible aspect to this light beam in the first place? If I was doing this, I'm not saying this is, you know, something I would do, and I'm not saying that anybody faked anything, but if I were faking something like this, I would say there was an invisible force that was pulling me towards the ship. I would not say it was blue. I would not attempt to photograph a blue beam. I would just kind of be chill about it and say, hey, why would it have to be visible? So this is interesting. And at the end of the chapter, we do have Frances's account of this, and she tells, unsurprisingly, the same story Ed does, and you know, a little more terror as she's holding on to him as he's being tugged up toward the ship. This was her first experience with the blue beam, she said, and it terrified me. If the UFO had waited to fire, Ed's entire body would have been caught again. Would they have taken him, or had they just wanted to keep him from following the creature? So that's the question. Was he being abducted, or was he just sort of being deterred from hunting down the little guy? So again, that encounter was on the early morning, about 3:30 a.m. on December 3rd, 1987. Also on December 3rd, the Gulf Breeze Sentinel released an edition with some letters to the editor that describe some UFO encounters in the same area, but that aren't from Ed Walters. So these are additional sightings, and some of them from even earlier, such as this one. Dear Editor, I am very relieved to see the UFO photos. They look just like the photos, enclosed, that I took last June 86. I never showed mine to anybody for fear of ridicule. They were taken with a 35mm after dusk, facing west in Shoreline Park South. It came from behind the north trees, very fast, and then stopped perfectly still. It stayed there for 5 or 6 seconds before flashing off to the north and out of my sight. It happened so fast that I doubted what I had seen. The film came back from the developer with no prints of the object, but then I checked the negatives and there it was. The developer had not printed them, thinking they were too dark. Like the other person, I too don't need the headaches that this can bring, so I withhold my name. I've got a scan of this story with the photo from June of 1986, and it's pretty grainy and difficult to see. However, it is reprinted in full color in Walters' book, and this is supposedly taken by somebody he says named Jane, in quotes, not her real name. And this photograph looks remarkably like the ones that Walters took. It's not a Polaroid. This is a 35mm photo, but you've got the same sort of round craft with a little dome at the top and lights on the bottom. There's no blue tinge. It's more of an orange or amber tinge to the lights, but like I said earlier, I wonder if some of the color variations in here might be the quality of the film, the old Polaroid film, for example. There was another letter to the editor that has a sighting that took place at the same time that Walter's initial sighting did. Dear UFO Sider, my husband and I feel you are not alone. However, I'm not sure if we saw the same thing. It was about 5:30 to 6:30 that evening. We were in our car. The object was overhead. At first, we thought it might be a plane or helicopter. However, when we rolled down the window of the car, we heard no noise. Did you hear a noise from it? Was it between 5:30 and 6:30 Wednesday evening? I remember my husband saying when we saw it, "That's not a plane. No plane can stay still like that." And it did just bob up and down. He said it wasn't a helicopter, for it made no noise. He rolled down the window and stuck out his head. I said, "Get your head in, for if it is a UFO, it may zap us up." We laughed and said if we told anyone, they would take us away in white jackets. We thought it may be from the Air Force also, but we doubted it. Please let us know if yours made noise. Signed, Anonymous. There was also a statement from the editorial side of things. They said, in the past 2 weeks, the Sentinel has been monitoring local UFO sightings, many centering around an object photographed November 11th by a Gulf Breeze resident. Since the publishing of the three pictures on November 19th, another photo taken last year of a similar object has been submitted to the paper and is shown below. We are having all photos analyzed by experts and will publish results as they become available. Readers are encouraged to continue sending all reports to the Sentinel. So the newspaper is sort of seeing they've got something going on here that is pretty impressive and is garnering lots of engagement from the from their readers. In Ed Walter's book, he talks about how after these sort of corroborating reports begin to circulate, local news begins to get involved. They have other people coming forward saying things or talking to photographic experts who verify that it's very difficult to fake things with Polaroid photos, since the Polaroid, it's developed right there. You've got all the emulsion and everything sort of there in one unit. And while all of this is going on, the Walters are increasingly concerned that their identity is going to be revealed, and they are continuing to have these encounters, including one on December 5th that involved a different kind of spacecraft. It was early on a Saturday morning, about 5:30 in the morning. Ed gets up, doesn't want to wake the rest of the family, goes out to the kitchen, he's making coffee, looks out the window. The UFO is there, but it's different. He says it's bigger. That was pretty much it. He says it was different, really different. It was bigger. So that is his description. He goes outside. He gets a gun and a camera, goes outside, and it's higher in the air. It's hovering. It's above the trees. And then he hears the voice. "Do not resist. Stay where you are. You are in danger. We will not harm you. Zehas." I turned and ran back into the house thinking, "Won't harm me, my ass. Right, I know all about your blue light and I'm not interested. I know what it can do." I hadn't said anything, but the voice answered, "Zehas." This was more of a sound than a name. "We have come for you." The UFO hovered slowly across the field, once again very low to the ground. By now, I figured that everybody on my street would have seen the UFO. Surely someone had called the police. The voice, no. No? No what? Nobody had seen them? Nobody had called the police? No, don't run away? I watched them from under the big porch roof. No way was I going to budge. I should have taken more photos, but I was afraid to cover my eyes with the camera, afraid to take my eyes off it as it moved closer. Finally, I pointed the pistol at the UFO. I yelled, "I'll shoot!" My voice didn't come out right. Again, "I'll shoot!" The words echoed as if they were in a pipe. No. Step forward. Screw you, come and get me. Flash. They were gone. Again, straight up. I went back into the house, quietly closing the door behind me, questions racing through my head. What the hell did they want from me? Why all these cryptic messages? When would all of this be over? The UFO voice actually seemed to be calling me by name. Not my name, but Zehas, whatever that was. The voice was clear when it said, "Zehas, we have come for you." What the hell was going on? Unsurprisingly, Ed is getting kind of concerned now that there is a clear indication that the aliens are coming for him in particular, and that his neighbors apparently aren't able to see this and aren't able to call the police. He says that his mind whirled with confusion, he felt sick, and he had to get help somehow. Now, Francis's account of this particular encounter is honestly, like many of Francis's accounts in for some of these early sightings, not interesting from a point of view of corroborating Ed's story necessarily, but interesting from the point of view of she is there, she's helping manage the household. They've got two kids in high school. Their son is you know, taking the SATs or whatever and getting ready to, you know, go off to college. And, you know, the kids' grades are slipping. The UFO stuff is stressing out the whole family. So we get that side of the story, which is pretty interesting. And I'd love to know if the kids who were teenagers at the time and obviously not now, I wonder if they've written anything about this. I haven't found anything, but if it's out there, I'm sure somebody will point it out. By this time, it's almost mid-December of 1987, and more witnesses are coming forward reporting sightings of things not entirely unlike what Ed and Francis had seen. On December 17th, the Francises have their sixth sighting. Again, awakened or roused by strange noises, sounds, premonitions. Ed goes outside. He's got his camera. He is going to see the craft. He's going to take pictures of it. As he opens his eyes, to the side of his bed are three dark figures. There's a streetlight coming in, illuminating them. He can't talk, but then they're gone. He's dizzy. He gets up. He goes outside to take pictures. Francis comes out with him. He runs out of film as he's taking pictures of a craft. She brings him more film. He gets zapped by the beam, but it doesn't affect him too deeply. And one interesting thing about this craft, this is another one of the larger ones. From the light underneath, some liquid comes out and falls to the ground. And Ed said he got some in a butter container and he was going to save it for future analysis. So this is more of a low-key sighting, as low-key as these get. But one thing that strikes me about these encounters, and I'm not saying anything about the veracity of the photographs. We'll talk about the veracity of the photographs in the future. It is astonishing to me that in the terror and horror and confusion and fear that Ed Walters is undergoing while seeing these craft, while being zapped at by beams, while seeing strange creatures next to his bed and hearing conversations in Spanish and being told that his name apparently is Zehas and they have come for him, that he's still able to snap off fairly clear, fairly well-composed photographs of the craft while all this is going on. I think this is absolutely remarkable. It's an amazing, astounding thing. Again, not being sarcastic, I'm thinking if this is what happened, then his equanimity in the face of the unknown is fairly admirable. One thing that continues to come through in these encounters is Ed's insistence on at least portraying himself in the book as a very kind of, like I said before, he's a tough guy. You know, he's you know, slinging some profanity at the space people, and he's being defiant, and he's taking pictures whether they want him to or not. But it's interesting. I think it's interesting. And we are getting to an interesting part of the story as we come to the close of this first part of our Gulf Breeze UFO sighting series of episodes, because we are getting into the portion of the story very soon here where the investigation begins to pick up the pace and the Mutual UFO Network begins to get involved. It begins on December 27th, 1987. In the chapter, this is titled The Preliminary Investigation, and Donald Ware, the state director of MUFON for Florida, comes and talks to Ed. Late in the day, Donald Ware brought me a copy of the report he intended to file with MUFON. It contained copies of the first five photos, measurements of the site where they had been taken, and the information I had given them from Mr. X. Donald told me to ask Mr. X to review the report for accuracy. There was a certain look in his eyes, the "I know that you are really Mr. X" look. He didn't say anything more, just gave me the report and left. I skimmed the pages, picking up a word here and there, then dropped the report on my desk. I'd read it later. Now I wasn't in the mood. I didn't want to get all the UFO information churning in my head. You know, it's always a strange experience for me when somebody gives me the "I know you are really Mr. X" look. What kind of look is that? I think there's a better way that he could have phrased it. So Ed is getting kind of overwhelmed by all of this stuff going on. He doesn't know why there's now a different kind of UFO there. Why are they after him? He closes his office door, he's wrapping a Christmas present for Francis, and a soft ringing starts in his head. This is different from a typical ringing in the ears. It's a lower pitch. It started to get louder until it became that hum. And this gets kind of weird. At first, I sat at my desk and looked out the window, searching for any strange glow in the sky. Nothing. I left my office. I calmly crossed through the living room so as not to disturb my daughter, smiling at her as I passed. If I panicked, she would follow me and become even more frightened of the UFO than she already was. I went out onto the backyard, steadied myself against one of the wooden windscreens, and watched the sky. The hum was really rolling now. I felt as if my brain was vibrating from the force of it. My son, Dan, stuck his head out the back door and asked if I was okay. I tried to appear calm as I replied, "Sure, no problem. Just looking at the pool water. We need to vacuum the bottom." I knew that all I had to say was "pool vacuum" and Dan would disappear. He went back inside and I wanted to grab my head and scream. The hum pressed deep into my head. If it didn't stop, what then? 5 minutes passed. The hum was like a siren pulsing with its high-low pitch. The last time the hum had done this, the UFO had dropped from the sky and the voice demanded that I step forward. I was sweating. What if they were going to do this until I broke down? Nobody could live with this vibration constantly squeezing and throbbing in their head. I thought about getting in the truck and trying to drive farther away from it, but I realized I wouldn't even know which way to go. Another 4 minutes passed, and suddenly the hum stopped. I slumped down and sat at the edge of the wooden deck with the dog at my feet. My shirt was wet and I could feel the sweat running down my back. I was cold and wanted just to go to sleep. The hum lasted about 10 minutes. The next day, I discovered that during the same time, a man calling himself Believer Bill had taken 9 photographs of 3 UFOs he had seen less than 2 blocks from my house. And we're going to pick things up with Believer Bill and his experiences, and of course, more sightings by the Walterses next time. But as we close out this first part of the Gulf Breeze sighting experience, I just want to say that if you're wondering where the skepticism is, don't worry. It's coming. These encounters sound amazing. The photos look fantastically clear in some cases. But this isn't going to be an easy ride for Ed Walters and Francis Walters and those who are supportive of their sightings. There's going to be contention. And that contention is going to start kicking off next time. But for right now, you've got an idea of what Ed and his family are going through, the kinds of experiences he's having, and some hints that this is more than just a lights-in-the-sky sighting case. But it's not quite an abduction. Not yet. Thanks for listening. Remember to send in your questions and comments via the usual social media or email channels, and we will address them next time on the show as we continue with the Gulf Breeze experience. Let's just call it the Gulf Breeze experience. Our associate producer is Simpson J. Hanover III, and The Saucer Life is a production of Chizo Media, LLC. Chizo Media, our heart is with the people. Until next time, keep watching the skies, because the skies are watching you.